I hope you still feel that way when we get through. I suppose there has been no word more often defined than love. And there is also, perhaps, no word about which there is as much misunderstanding and conflict of opinion as in this simple four-letter word. I think we can start, perhaps, by a study of affection as it is found in Neoplatonism, which I think was a wonderful combination of philosophy and mysticism. It flourished in both Athens and Alexandria in the opening years of the Christian era, and certainly considerably affected early Christian mysticism. According to the Neoplatonists, love exists on a whole series of levels. It is not just a simple, single emotion. It consists of a series of aspects or interpretations which relate to the various specialties of human consciousness. In other words, love can be applied to a wide variety of phenomena in life. According to the Neoplatonists, the highest form of love, so far as humanity is concerned, is love of God. And the highest conceivable form of love is God's love for man. And this God's love is represented especially in the great sacrifice in which God gives his Son for the salvation of man. Therefore, whether it be in Christian or neo-Christian philosophy, love is a divine quality by substance in its own highest and most essential nature. It is therefore a certain solicitude, a deep and abiding emotional attachment by which the individual expresses devotion through conduct, through the service of the beloved. This was the foundation of both Platonic and Neoplatonic definition of love. And it passes through a whole series of modifications. Next to the love of God, where do we turn? The Neoplatonist said, the next love in importance is the love of truth. Truth becomes the most precious thing available to the human being on his own level of existence. Truth must be regarded as the thing or power that heals all wounds, that reveals to man fully and clearly the affection of God for him. Truth, therefore, represents a series of realities in existence which were placed there for the salvation of living things. To know the truth is to free oneself of the errors of ignorance. But again, truth is a very difficult word to define. That which is truth for one person may not be truth for another. And the underlying eternal and inevitable truth is still beyond the common acceptances of human beings. To each person, truth is his way of looking at reality. And as this is true of countless persons, we do have a kind of definition for truth, namely that it is reality as seen through the sensory perceptions of the human being. And because human beings are different, not only in degrees of inward perceptions, but in their devotions and dedications to those values which they believe, then we find a great chain of secondary circumstances and definitions which are important in the study of man's affections and the proper bestowal of them upon the realities and significant values of living. Among the Neoplatonists, perhaps the next level of truth or love was wisdom. And wisdom is primarily love of truth. And because truth itself is so extremely abstract and difficult to capture even by the mind, wisdom is therefore respected, honored, and regarded with affection because it opens the way to the achievement of truth. Therefore, we should love wisdom. We should love all of the forms of knowledge by which we are inspired to search for ultimate truth. The search must continue, but we must also be grateful for the abilities we have to achieve the ends we seek. Therefore, gratitude is a form of love. Gratitude is the individual accepting graciously the good things that happen to him, or the good deeds that are done on his behalf. And next, perhaps, in all of the Neoplatonic thinking, we have love as a love of beauty. The beautiful surrounds us in life. And if we are properly integrated people, we find in beauty an object for affection. We love the beautiful. And while this love is an impersonal kind of love, we now come also to the realization that love can be impersonal, that love does not necessarily have to have a personal object. Love can be devoted or dedicated to values which are not visible, may not even be definable by the average person, but still have a real effect upon us. And one of the most important of these is the love of beauty. And this has been with us since the dawn of time. Even in our most primitive culture groups, there were efforts to express beauty. Now, the beauty expressed was sometimes a faint shadow of the artistry that we think about today. Man's primitive knowledge of beauty was very scanty. Yet to himself, it meant something. It was an achievement. It was like a small child trying to draw a picture. The picture is meaningful to that child and represents the highest degree of its capacity at the moment, but may not have any influence or interest for other people. So love of beauty brings with it also love of all the arts as expressions and as testimonies and as inspirations up to conduct. We have music and painting and sculpturing. We have the dance and the theater. We have all kinds of manifestations of beauty on the level of aesthetics. Now, beauty on the level of aesthetics is something that comes against another problem in human nature, namely that the average individual does not have a clear enough concept of value within himself to be able to support with his own additional concern the various arts which are possible to him. The arts of Asia come in here as a very interesting sideline of thought. The Chinese painters were tremendously ensouled or deeply inspired by a strange kind of love. And that was the love for the manifestation of the divine in all the creations which come through man himself. Natural love comes from the adoration of nature. Human love, very largely through man's appreciation of nature, as this is captured in painting and in etchings and in all the different forms by which we attempt to perpetuate our own evaluation of the beautiful around us. Another level of love, of course, is love of virtue. The virtuous life, the effort of the individual to live upon the highest level of his attainments constitutes a level of appreciation relating to love. Love, therefore, must love the good, must serve the beautiful, and must recognize the eternity of the One. These things together constitute a triad of attributes by which it is possible to more or less arrive at a working definition of infinite affection. Now, as we go down the line still further, we come to various forms which we distinguish in ourselves, and among these are human relationships. Therefore, love to the average person is a human emotion. It is an emotion based upon affection for persons. This type was called love of family, love of humanity. The Greeks were well aware of this form, and so were the Chinese, who made a very strong philosophical case for family love. They called it more or less fidelity. It was the fact that in the home there was not only mutual affection, but a mutual regard. And that affection was based upon the superior conduct of those loved. Love was not merely a relationship due to family birth. A child did not love a parent because merely it was a parent. The child loved the parent because the parent was good, was kind, was understanding, and was in turn lovable. Therefore, personal love is based upon qualities which to each person appear to be lovable. Some find it in one way and some in another. But in the family life, love is essential to the survival of the home and is the basis of all human relationships in this world. We love that which is worthy of love, worthy of affection. And unless we demand some level of worthiness, our affections become promiscuous and lose the value of moral support. So family love is love of parent for child, husband for wife, and vice versa, and parents for children, and children for parents. And, of course, to a certain measure, this extends to the friend or the visitor within the family environment. All of this depends entirely for its integrity upon the fact that those loved are lovable. It is a very difficult and usually fruitless effort to love that which is not lovable. This doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but we should not expect the impossible. Unless we can really say that we find communion, unless there is some reasonable reason for our affection, we are not capable of definite love. If this is lacking, then we may depend upon respect or regard of a lesser nature, or even depend upon duty as remaining where personal feelings may have been hopelessly weakened. Therefore, some families are held together by duty alone. Some are held together by economic necessities. Some are held together by domination of one person over others. But unless beauty is present in its natural freedom, its natural sharing of all that is good, the home life is insecure. And if the home life is insecure, future generations are endangered. So love of family is very much involved in our relationships. Then, of course, the Greeks, like almost all other people, said love of country, patriotism, or devotion to the system which we believe to be acceptable in government. In all times, from now and then past, as far back as we can go, love of government has been sketchy. Very few people are entirely satisfied with their governments. Most people believe that their governments are misrepresenting them, or that government is a burden upon the human being, and that it is a source of exploitation and of various corruptions. I think in this particular case, however, we have to face the simple reality that corruption does not live long unless it is supported. And most persons are not sufficiently firm in their affection for anything, except perhaps their bank books, to have a proper attitude towards their responsibilities. Love has responsibilities as well as opportunities. That which we love, we must help to maintain its own integrities. And if these integrities are slipping away, we must do everything possible to restore them. Also, we have various other forms of affection. We have love of friends. And friendship is a very firm affection, as told in the ancient story of Damon and Pythias. Friendship is sometimes the most powerful form of affection, because in many instances relatives are not sincere, but a friend we assume to be sincere. And friendship becomes an emotion of sincerity. This, of course, is very often corrupted by ulterior motive. We cultivate people for what we hope to get from them, not for what we hope to give them. And the corruption or dilution of affection is always a sad tragedy. But it is true very definitely that sometimes, in fact, more than sometimes, friendship is the strongest bond that we have in this world, much stronger than brotherhood. Because brotherhood very often represents relatives in a family who are not true to each other or have no common ground in integrities. So we go down through all these different levels. There are more than we can possibly list. Love of animals. This is quite important, because in many instances, these other creatures contribute very much to our own integrities. They provide us solace in times of emergency. They provide us means of advancing, maintaining our farms and institutions, and they are very much present as an educational force in the life of children. So there is love of animals and the dedication not to injure, without cause, any living thing. Now, this does not mean that we can always preserve them, but it means that we should have a natural affection and that our first regard of them should be that of friendship. Friendship with other kingdoms is quite a possibility. I remember very definitely a beautiful experience in the Kasuga Parks in Nara in Japan. In this temple, which is a Shinto sanctuary, there are vast parks, and in these parks, the temple deers wander about in a condition of complete friendliness. They will come up alongside of you and walk with you. They will look up at you with those soulful eyes that nothing can resist, and also hope with this touch of humanity that we're going to feed them something. I remember that I had some feed for them in my hand, and one of them came up behind me, put his head under my arm, under my jacket, and put his head up and looked at me. It was irresistible. Not only that, but in the spirit of the thing, as soon as I gave him the little morsels, he bowed to me. He bowed appreciation. He had been well tutored in knowing when there was a likelihood of more food. But the animal is always a wonderful experience. Therefore, love of animals comes very often from having pets when you are children and growing up with a certain regard for life, a regard which is part of love and a very serious part of love. At the Sarasawa Pond, also in Nara, there is a little lake, I guess it's an artificial one, but it's large enough to contain quite a few fish and so on. There is a ritual performed there quite frequently. children will go to a little store in the town, and they'll buy a goldfish in a little glass bowl about the size of a drinking glass. Then the children, the family, and the priest, probably, will all go to down to the shore of the lake, and we'll go through the ritual of releasing the goldfish. The child has saved his spending money to buy a goldfish for the purpose of releasing it. Now, this is quite contrary to our thinking. We'd probably put it in a bowl and let it stand around a while until it went out of existence by natural causes. But to these people, the release of the living thing was much more important than keeping it in your own house. Make it not a prisoner, but liberate it. And the process of liberating birds and animals throughout Asia has been quite common in many parts of, those continents. At the time of the special celebration in honor of President Grant, back in the middle of the last century, the celebration included the release of birds so that they could carry the glad tidings. And every type of living thing that is lovable should be loved. And if we cannot love them closely because of their natures, we can at least recognize a kinship with all that lives. And this is very important. Ernest Thompson Seton told me once an interesting story. While he was a great naturalist, as you know, and one time when he was out drawing and sketching, he saw a deer coming toward him. And the deer was running away from a hunter with a gun. And the deer was uncertain where to go, what to do. He evidently sensed danger. And then what he did was to run over to Seton and stand there beside him. The deer took refuge with the human being. And another human being was out to shoot the deer. This is life. But these types of things should be remembered always in judging our relationships with life in all of its aspects and attributes. We do not destroy for sport. We do not destroy for skill. And we try to preserve life as much as we can. And when it comes close to us, we try to serve it to the best of our ability. This is a distinct and solid form of love. It is far more valuable in the development of the human being than all the protestations of affection that are possible. Then there comes two forms of love which are particularly exemplified in Oriental philosophy. They are covered very largely in the New Testament also, but in slightly different words. In Buddhism, the northern school, there are two deities, the Bodhisattva Kannan, or Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy, and the world savior to come, the Buddha or Bodhisattva Maitreya. Now, these words are very interesting because they're names of something. And Kannan is compassion. This deity is the embodiment of man's compassion for all that lives. Any enmities, any antagonisms, any old family feuds that interfere with the natural growth of the individual have a penalty which very few of us really want to pay. Therefore, we have to prevent that penalty from arising. The Goddess of Mercy, so-called, in the Far East, represents the infinite kindliness for all living things. These deities, Kannan, for instance, was not truly a god, nor a goddess. Kannan, according to Buddhism, was once a mendicant, maybe millions of years ago on another star, who dedicated his existence to the service of humanity and gradually grew up and took an obligation which continues in Northern Buddhism to this day, that he will not, or she will not, because both forms exist, seek final emancipation from life, will not seek infinite release into eternity, into the great nirvana, until this being can take with it every other living creature. Now, this is a very beautiful thought, even though we may not be able always to grasp it, that there can be no release for those who love truth, God, or their fellow man, until they can carry with them into peace those around them. And this service is not the individual looking for release for himself, but sacrificing his own hope of peace to give peace to someone else. Now, when we get into this level of thinking, we really begin to understand love. For love is always the forgetting of self. It is not because we lose all the attractiveness of it, which we will have to come to in a few minutes, but because of the infinite magnitude of the situation. The Buddha to come, according to Northern Buddhism, and that includes the Tibetan, Japanese, Korean, and Bhutan groups, is called Maitreya, or Miraku. The word means kindness. That is the meaning of the word. It's not a name, really. It is a word. And it's the definition of it is that Miraku is the hope of all nations, the hope of all that lives. And at the end of all strife, the second coming of the Messiah, for Miraku was the desired Messiah to come in Buddhism. The second coming of Christ is kindness in the human heart. You'd go a hard time to get a better philosophy than that. It would be very difficult to find a more ennobling concept. And yet there's something about it that is so essentially true. And in Northern Buddhism especially, the realizations of these facts have never disturbed the individual. They have never made them sorrowful, or feel that they are frustrated, or that they are inhibited, or that they cannot do what they want to do. Because according to their thinking, when love comes, you do what love wants you to do. You find your own complete happiness and fulfillment in the service of values higher than yourself, and or more needy than your own. Until these realizations strike us, we have very little understanding of the responsibility of true love. Now, in other nations also, we find, especially in the words of Christ, insistence upon love. We often think of Christ as a spirit of love, and this probably is the essential meaning embodied in a great cosmological phenomenon. But the actual thing, as Paul says, Christ in you, the hope of glory. And among the words of Jesus, we remember the ones that goes to this way, those who do not love their brother who they have seen, how can they love their God whom they have not seen? The idea that the individual can have a religious life without expressing creative and constructive affection is just wrong. Because there can be no religion apart from the practice of the virtues attributed to the sacred books as necessary. Paul says, and the greatest of these are faith, hope, and charity, now translated love. And the greatest of these is love. Now, the idea of placing affection as the standard of conduct will probably come as much of a surprise to people. But in the great pattern of things, we all exist because of a love beyond our comprehension. We all live because of a beautiful world that was given to us. Wonderful opportunities. We bring other children into the world with the opportunity to love them. to help them to grow and to improve and to fulfill their destinies. Children are not ours to control or demand. They are ours to protect and serve and bring up to the point where they can be released constructively into society. We must do almost the same thing with the children that we do when we release the birds in the Japanese ceremony. We release all life to the fulfillment of itself, but we do all that we possibly can to make that life as rich and noble as it can be before it goes out on its own journey. All these things are values that are not difficult. They are not sad, horrible things. They are not the cause of atomic bombs and all this type of thing. The thing that is causing our trouble is that in some strange way we have mistaken the meaning of the word love. Perhaps one of the problems that we have is that self-interest takes dominance over practically every other emotion in the lives of modern people. Each individual is protecting himself against those who in one way or another have despitefully used him. He is therefore inclined to try to return evil for evil. If someone is unkind, he feels justified in being unkind also. And on this policy, unkindness goes on forever. For there is never a time when we will not have some aspect of it, unless, as individuals, we take a new viewpoint of our own lives. How can we, as individuals, therefore, find out a better use of our own emotions? How can we recognize the true meaning of affection? Now we descend into what might be termed the secular level of emotions. We no longer think just in terms of the divine plan. We think in terms of daily relationships, human love, personal love. This level is, according to both the Chinese and the early Christians, a perfectly noble level. Love, in its truest sense, is always right. It is always virtuous. It is always ensouling and inspiring. Therefore, that the individual who wishes to find God should give up human affections is wrong, because God is in those human affections and he must perfect his understanding there before he can go further. Therefore, love in the family, love in the home, personal affections for each other are very noble as long as we do not pervert them, as long as we do not misuse these emotions or compromise them or defile them in one way or another. The actual answer to most domestic problems is, therefore, a clean love. And until we get that, the human relationships will remain embittered and obscured. Now, love in family and home is something which makes things happy. Most of the peoples of other countries who have their own little philosophies of love are laughing people. We are the only ones, apparently, who find love a burden or the basis of something which is too difficult for us to handle. Well, perhaps it's due to the complications of our way of life. We have become so bound up in transitory and impermanent values that we have lost the sense of directness. We are now constantly frustrated, worried, frightened, and seeking in affection not an expression of service, but an escape from some physical restriction upon our own conduct. Therefore, it is true that we have to work out the problem of human relationships on the level of an integrity. For people in all walks of life, the foundation of love is law. In other words, the law as it is, the law of love, is the only basis upon which problems of human existence can be arbitrated. There is no way in which we can ever solve the human problem without love. There is no way also that we can love as long as we are selfish. As long as our own ulterior motives dominate our human relationships, as long as our love centers upon the gratification of our own desires at the expense of others, and if every time in which love loses its liberty, loses its freedom, is a misfortune. But love free will never break a rule. Love free will never do that which is unrealistic or impure, because love itself is the very essence of God's affection for mankind. Therefore, anything that is a corruption is no longer love. Anything that is dominated by ulterior motive is no longer pure affection. As long as self-interest, selfishness, gratifications of appetites dominate affection, we will never have any real love. And as a result of the lack of this love, homes are breaking up every minute, and young people are almost afraid to establish them. Then we look out into the great pattern of the world, nations out to destroy each other. For why? For what reason? For what justifiable cause? None. The hatreds which we have nursed for generations simply corrupt and corrode our own lives. Family feuds go on for generations, and everyone seeking to solve a problem seeks to find self-gratification or self-freedom from responsibility. We believe that everything that goes wrong should be blamed on someone else. I know when I was quite young, we had a kind of a family of feuders. Our background had three generations of people who weren't speaking to each other. Well, every one of them had good old Scotch reasons, but they weren't really very good. But after a while, my illustrious grandmother, whom some of you have become acquainted with, decided that I needed a little religious training. So, being a Scotch lady, she chose the Presbyterian Church, and I went to Sunday school there. And that was my first direct contact with the Bible. We had read readings, but the first time we'd really gone into serious thought about it. And in the course of the readings, I found out so many wonderful things that seemed so good, such as to forgive your adversary immediately and do good to those that despitefully use you. Well, that sounded to me like I was already a missionary. So I took the glad tidings home, and I was thoroughly punished. I was told that it was none of my business, and that anyone who should say you should love those that despitefully use you should have your head examined. Well, it's in the Bible. It is known that these truths are there. But the moment these truths come in contact with a personal antagonism, so much the worse for the truths. They don't have a chance. And that is happening all the time in our modern society. Talking with young people, they tell me that they have no real intention of establishing permanent relationships. They're just going to enjoy life the best they can as they go along. And if it doesn't work out, that's just too bad. Well, this type of thinking is bound to ultimately destroy most of our cultural life. The compromise of our integrities is never worse than when it compromises those divine attributes which have been placed in the human being. And one of them is the love of God living in us. And where we treat this badly or misuse it or pervert it, we have committed truly a sin against the Holy Spirit. And this is not something that we can do with impunity. It gradually results in increasing difficulties and tragedies, and life becomes more and more unlivable, of which we don't really want to have happen. Now, we also find another interesting area of affection, and that is, in a sense, love of knowledge. We all want to be well educated. We want to go to school. We want to develop some skill in life. Now, a skill in life is a very good thing to develop. Unfortunately, our modern educational system does not do an outstanding job of this. It has more or less compromised things down to the economic level. We work because we hope to make money. And if we do not make money, we soon find out that we are not welcome in this society. But education and knowledge are important because we have too many people of good intention who really are lovable people, but they have no experience in anything. They are unable to handle their own affairs. They are unable to help other people. They simply do not have the practical insights that make usefulness significant in society. Therefore, in connection with knowledge, it seems that we who love God should also take special pains in how we learn the lessons of life. We can always learn some of them in the University of Hard Knocks, but that isn't quite sufficient. Everyone should dedicate a skill to the service of humanity. If we love people, and if we love God, and if we love truth, we have to develop a practical way of service. Love without some type of commitment to usefulness is merely a travesty, an excuse, an evasion, or a simple example of ignorance. To find a way of helping is our way of loving people. And to love them and to help them, we must be helpful people. And this means that a part of our lives should be devoted to the other interpretation of love, charitas, or charity. Charity being the service of others, the doing of good deeds to those who need them. Now, in this time in our cultural existence, we are not much devoted to this because of the economic involvements. And the whole problem of trying to be a servant in the house of the Lord gets to be pretty difficult. We cannot always do all kinds of big things, but if we have some background of a skill of some kind, we can help somebody sometime. If we learn how to run a family, if we know how to clean a house, if we know the principles of proper food, if we know anything that makes us helpful, we can help. So every life should have in it a dedication to being helpful, to find some way of expressing our concern for the common good, and should come forward whatever necessary to support ideas and principles which seem to be better than those we are living by today. Therefore, part of our affection for our neighbor and our world is that we shall inspire the improvement of the various systems which are necessary to the maintenance of civilization. All these things come very much into focus. Now also we have another problem that is rather a sticky wicket, and that is, how much should we love ourselves? I don't think most people underestimate this too much. They do fairly well in most cases, but we have to think this through a little bit more. Sometimes we ridicule the idea of anyone thinking about themselves or loving themselves. But actually, if we get onto the proper level, it's just part of the same picture. There's no reason why we should love other people and leave ourselves out. Because actually, the same power of good that we hope to share with another, we must hope to share with ourselves. So each individual has the duty and responsibility to make him or herself lovable.